I think this is just a clear example of how exposed Palestinian lives are under Israeli occupation and apartheid, both in the West Bank and certainly in Gaza. The lack of any consequences, we expect Yinon Levy to not have to pay a significant price, is the result of policy, and it's also the result of international inaction. And it is so symbolic that the Trump administration essentially lifted the sanctions, the very meager sanctions that were imposed by the Biden administration on this individual, but it's an entire system of impunity and support for this settler terror that has been responsible and that we see as responsible for the killing of dear Ode Hadalin, who was really a friend to us all. Anyone who was active in the Masafer Yatta area knew Ode, stayed with him, spent time with him, and listened to him. He was an inspiring
Sarit
and amazing
Mikhaeli,
activist.
We're going to have to leave it there. I thank you for being with us with the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem.
It's a no. KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Jacob Hoops, a local activist and peaceful Quaker, was released after being abducted for 3 days. DHS has been caught lying about events leading up to protester convictions. And in national news, Trump is denying FEMA aid to Maryland. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 29, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. Oregon lawmakers have passed a groundbreaking bill mandating the integration of climate change education into classrooms statewide. Tanya Shepard, a founding member of Oregon Educators for Climate Education, and Michaela May, a high school student and climate advocate, view this legislation as an opportunity to help shape Oregon's future. The new law directs the State Board of Education to incorporate climate science, covering causes, effects, and adaptation strategies into core subjects such as science, history, health, and civics. The goal is to equip students with accurate information and age-appropriate tools to understand and respond to the climate crisis. Supporters argue that this bill represents a significant step toward normalizing climate education throughout the state, particularly in rural and underserved areas. Yesterday, on Monday, July 28th, a gathering was held outside of the Portland Justice Center as a hearing was held for Jacob Hoops, a Quaker pacifist who was abducted from his home on Friday morning. Hannah Francis has more.
On Monday, July 28th, there was a hearing for a local pacifist Quaker named Jacob Hoops, who was arrested and detained from his home on Friday morning. According to a personal account from his partner in a Facebook post, they were sleeping when, quote, a flood of armed officers race into our driveway and charge at our house with assault rifles, end quote. The federal officers banged on the door and pointed guns at them through the window, telling them to open the door when he asked if they had a warrant. Jacob's partner was told that Jacob was being detained for assaulting a federal officer at an ICE protest. Though his partner declined to make direct comments about the event, as it is an open case, they said that Jacob is, quote, a pacifist Quaker who is the most compassionate, loving, gentle person I have ever met. On Monday, July 28th, there was a gathering outside of the Department of Justice as Jacob had his hearing. There were several dozen people gathered there, and the court was full. Many members of Southwest Indivisible, members of 350PDX, and many members of the Quaker community, including Jacob's father, who came from Philadelphia, were all gathered outside. Among the people present were city councilors Angelita Murillo and Mitch Green. Samir Kunal went into the hearing to witness it.
I'm very grateful that Jacob and people like Jacob are out in the streets fighting for my community. I know that people are doing the right thing and finding all sorts of ways to help. I've only had the pleasure of meeting Jacob once. I actually know him mostly online, engaging on political stuff. But the one time I got to meet Jacob, there was a protest at city council, and I had a sort of impromptu convening with the protesters regarding immigration stuff. And it was a very frank and honest discussion. And it was a difficult discussion too, and people were very frustrated and angry, and rightfully so. And I remember his face because he was standing there, and the whole time he was looking at me, he was nodding, he was encouraging me to keep speaking and to keep engaging. And he just had a very sweet demeanor about him, the way that he chooses to engage in good faith with others, the way that he chooses to organize and to be in community. And I hope that we are ready to defend him in the ways that he was ready to come and defend my community. And I hope that we can all engage with each other in loving and supportive ways, the way that he would want, and the ways that are going to be necessary in the years ahead. So thank you all for being here. Your city councilors are watching.
This is really important in this moment because what they're doing to Jacob is an effort to intimidate us from standing up and saying, this is an obvious injustice, this is intolerable. And so the fact that we're out here and we're willing to hold the line and support Jacob means that this could spread. And this spreads through the organizations that we join, through the networks of solidarity that we come to, that we knit together. So thank you so much for being here.
Susie and Pedro were also there, the people who initially made the petition to revoke the ICE permit in Portland that was signed by more than 15,000 Portlanders. Pedro says that he is there in solidarity for all the people protesting ICE. And while he has never met Jacob, judging by the arrest, Pedro can see that Jacob wants ICE out of Portland too, and hopes that other people who went to the gathering there understood that too.
But I can see that this is a person who is very much, very committed to against ICE. And if it was arrested, it was because, I'm assuming, was near the detention center, and it's protesting the presence of ICE in this town. I don't necessarily have to go deep in knowing much more about his politics, but that informs me in that he does not want ICE in this town, because he won't go there to find, to, you know, when you protest something, you go all the way, right? You don't protest halfway through. And he's paying the biggest price right now, which is being held in a federal court facing charges. I think, you know, when counselors come and grandstand about and center themselves, when this person was actually doing something beyond or what they got there, when counselors actually have the power to revoke the permit based on human rights violations, when we know are the conditions that can actually revoke the permit, and come to this place and don't even address that, have their nerve to go around with narrative of, you know, when human rights are under attack, well, they hide behind bureaucracy, sit down, and don't fight back. That's their actual jingle, and they need to be straightforward with that. Is that when you fight, if you are an elected official and you have the power to do something, what they can do is to close down that building, and that they have the power. If they're not doing that, then they're not fighting. What is it? What is their fight right now? That is not that. That is actually having some positive effect on the immigrant community and those who are most affected. Nothing, right? Quite frankly, this is a person who's paying the biggest price. And so when politicians come here, they need to know that this is actually happening because they're keeping a building open when they actually have the power to actually close it down.
A person at the event, Yvette, commented as well.
I think it's important that we do show up for any member of the community who's fighting for our more marginalized communities. And at the same time, I think it's also important to not make that one person the center of the whole thing, right? This is one, the fight for Jacob is one kernel that's a part of the larger fight for our marginalized community, specifically non-documented people and people of color in our city, in our state, really. They're not mutually exclusive, but we can do both and, you know?
Jacob's partner acknowledged in her Facebook post, quote, "He and I also recognize the privilege we hold in being white, able-bodied people living in a quote-unquote nice neighborhood. If our bodies looked different, or if we lived in a different zip code, our situation could have been much more deadly," end quote. Jacob Hoops was released with an ankle tracker at 5 p.m. on July 28th. For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Hannah Francis.
In Los Angeles, multiple felony cases against protesters have been dismissed, revealing significant discrepancies in statements made by the Department of Homeland Security. A report from The Guardian highlights how misleading testimonies from law enforcement have led to the collapse of these cases following protests against recent immigration raids. Just 2 weeks after charges were filed, prosecutors moved to dismiss cases against four individuals in the interest of justice, due to errors in officers' testimonies. Social media footage contradicted claims made in criminal complaints, including an incident involving sisters Ashley and Jocelyn Rodriguez. While DHS alleged that Ashley pushed an officer, video evidence showed the officer pushing her instead. Key witness Eduardo Mejorado, a Border Patrol agent, admitted to misstating the sequence of events during the arrests, further undermining the prosecution's case. Video evidence also contradicted claims of assault against officers by other protesters. Of the 9 cases alleging assaults against law enforcement, 7 have been dismissed, although one defendant still faces pending charges with claims of misidentification. Following these developments, the Department of Justice has filed lower-level misdemeanor charges against some of the previously charged individuals. These errors raised concerns about DHS's credibility, as officials have previously overstated assault rates against officers to justify aggressive immigration enforcement strategies. The dismissals have sparked scrutiny, with grand juries already refusing to indict protesters involved in the anti-ICE demonstrations. The Trump administration wants stepped-up voter deregistration efforts. The U.S. will help get more food to starving Palestinians. And a federal judge rules Medicaid payments to Planned Parenthood must continue. With that story and more, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
How will you ever be able to contact that many people? How many will fall through the cracks? If contacted, will they be able to navigate a system that isn't always easy?
Raleigh, North Carolina's Mary Kay Helling wonders how many eligible voters know their names risk being scrubbed from voter rolls. She told a congressional hearing on registration list maintenance hers was one of 60,000 votes cast legally last fall that was nearly erased in a months-long legal challenge brought by a Republican court candidate. The Trump administration is now suing the state, claiming its registration database is inaccurate and more names have to be removed. In a break with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, President Donald Trump says the U.S. will work to set up food centers in Gaza as aid groups report of widespread starvation.
Those children look very hungry, but we're giving a lot of money and a lot of food, and other nations are now stepping up.
Israel is facing intense pressure to lift restrictions on food and other supplies entering the territory. The White House says there's a preliminary trade agreement with the European Union with a 15% tariff on most goods. That's less than the 30% Trump originally proposed, but the import taxes will still likely raise costs for Americans. Federal workers are free to express their religious beliefs and persuade their co-workers to, quote, rethink their own without fear of retaliation, according to a new White House memo. Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights Harmeet Dhillon says she's committed to rooting out what she calls woke ideology harming all people of faith.
The freedom to exercise one's faith is a core founding principle of our nation. An obvious example is the work this administration has already done to protect Jewish students from anti-Semitism on college campuses.
The new directive follows the formation of a new federal task force to expose, quote, anti-Christian bias in government. A federal judge has ruled the Trump administration must continue Medicaid funding for Planned Parenthood clinics. A provision in the recently passed federal budget would have prohibited health care providers that offer abortion from accepting Medicaid payments for any other services. Opponents sued, arguing that amounts to a backdoor abortion ban in states where it remains legal. The White House has restored nearly $6 billion in federal funding for education following bipartisan criticism and chaos at some local school districts. The money is designated for teacher training, English language education, and adult literacy programs. But Emily Wildow with New Mexico Voices for Children says she's still worried about what's next.
The proposal from the White House does include permanently cutting a lot of these programs that had their funding frozen in this fiscal year. So I think it's a bad omen for what's to come.
New Mexico had joined a lawsuit with more than 20 other states to challenge the funding freeze. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report with Lisa Loving. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be a high of 90 degrees and a low of 61 tonight. And tomorrow, it will be a high of 89 and a low of 63. Today in history, in 1958, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration was established. After being criticized for allowing the Soviet Union to launch the first man-made satellite to orbit Earth, U.S. President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed legislation that created NASA. The quote of the day is from Albert Einstein. He said, quote, "Only two things are infinite, the universe and human stupidity, and I'm not sure about the former." With the stroke of a pen Thursday, President Donald Trump has rescinded more than $1 billion in Corporation for Public Broadcasting funds. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. With a stroke of a pen Thursday, President Trump has rescinded more than $1 billion in Corporation for Public Broadcasting funds. Buffalo's Fire reports this loss will hit both large operations, including Koahnic Broadcasting, and especially small stations, including KUHB on St. Paul's Island in the Bering Sea. Such stations are tribally centered in their talk, music, and news programming, and managers are hard-pressed to know how to replace the lost funds while preserving culture and traditions. An app developed by a former NPR employee called Adopt a Station shows stations who've lost more than half their funding. Users can contact these stations and make a donation. An Arizona tribal chairman is the subject of a federal probe, but as KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, the reason behind why is still unclear.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs confirms its missing and murdered unit is investigating White Mountain Apache Chairman Casey Velasquez. The unit's special agents look into active cases, among other duties. A former tribal policeman, school administrator, and substance abuse counselor, Velasquez was first elected chairman in 2022 and also heads the Arizona Indian Gaming Association. His legal counsel, Kurt Altman, says that Velasquez will not be making any statements out of respect for the ongoing investigation that he's fully cooperating with, adding that they look forward to a rapid conclusion. The chairman is up for re-election next year. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
A First Nation in Canada is cashing in on an artificial intelligence data center to build up its economy. Seoul Traverso reports.
The Woodland Cree First Nation is building an AI data center on its traditional territory in Alberta. The project will convert a partially completed power plant into a 650 megawatt natural gas powered data center. Isaac Labocon Avram is the chief of the Woodland Cree First Nation. He wants to find other means to build a self-sufficient economy.
You have to be diverse, right? Like, we just don't want to rely on oil and gas and forestry. We want to see what we can be a part of wherever a solid opportunity is.
There's a push by world leaders for businesses to invest in AI. Canada recently appointed its first minister of artificial intelligence. And President Donald Trump says he wants to expedite building permits for AI data centers and for the U.S. to be a global leader in AI. John Horstman is the chief financial officer for Sovereign Digital Infrastructure.
Data centers and AI is, I think, a huge opportunity for productivity growth right across humanity, really, to access information, to enable people to kind of move faster, be smarter. What's really the limiting condition on the growth of AI is access to power.
Horstman is partnering with Woodland Cree to develop this data center. He says there's opportunities for First Nations and Indigenous communities with natural resources. Since data centers require a lot of fuel and water to power themselves, a single large data center can consume between 1 million and 5 million gallons of water a day. Chief Labocon Avram says they're going to be mindful of the environmental footprint this data center will have.
Us as a First Nation having majority control of it, we will definitely want to see the best in world-class environmental protections.
Labocon Avram did not want to speculate on any financial projections of the center, but said that this will be built over several years and expects to bring in hundreds of jobs.
I'm hoping it is a game changer. I want to pave our roads. I want to help out our elders in ways that we're not able to help them now. I want to invest in education, better housing, etc. So the hope of that is getting some of these economic development opportunities a chance.
For National Native News, I'm Sol Traverso.
And I'm Brian Bull from the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
A new jobs report, set to be released on August 1st, may shed light on the growing effects of the Trump administration's immigration crackdown on the U.S. labor market. Bloomberg predicts that the Labor Department will report a gain of about 20,000 to 30,000 jobs, less than average. Business demand for workers is waning amid uncertainty over tariffs, while a shrinking supply of job candidates is particularly impacting industries with high foreign-born worker populations, such as agriculture, construction, and food manufacturing. Food manufacturing employment has stagnated this year, and construction payrolls rose by only 35,000 in the first half of 2025, compared to 104,000 during the same period last year. A recent report from Capital Economics noted this crackdown is beginning to have a more marked impact on labor supply. The U.S. labor force shrank by 130,000 in June and is down 364,000 since January, with the labor force participation rate dipping to 62.3%, the lowest since December 2022. Detentions by ICE have surged from an average of 15,000 a month in 2024 to nearly 40,000 in early June, with deportations rising significantly. The foreign-born labor force has contracted over 1 million people in the past 4 months, leading to workforce shortages in essential sectors like restaurants and manufacturing. Labor attorney Amy Peck emphasized that businesses are struggling, with many closing early or consolidating locations. "It's pretty dire," she stated. This marks a significant shift from 2019 to 2024, when immigrants contributed to 88% of the nation's labor force. Current net immigration has dropped to an annual rate of 500,000, down from about 900,000 before the pandemic. Moody's economist Marisa Tinadale warned that these immigration-related worker shortages could reduce the nation's potential economic growth from 2% to 1%. This creates a split job market, where some industries cannot find workers while others see hiring slow. Researchers at the University of Florida have made significant strides in cancer treatment with an experimental mRNA vaccine that enhances the effects of immunotherapy. Published in Nature Biomedical Engineering, The study reveals that pairing this vaccine with immune checkpoint inhibitors can trigger a robust anti-tumor response. Rather than targeting specific tumor proteins, the vaccine works by stimulating the immune system to act as if it's fighting a virus. This is achieved by increasing the expression of a protein called PD-L1 within tumors, making them more receptive to treatment. Senior author Dr. Elias Sayor, a pediatric oncologist, highlighted the potential for this approach to serve as an alternative to conventional treatments like surgery and chemotherapy. "This study suggests a new paradigm in cancer vaccine development," said co-author Dr. Dwayne Mitchell. "By using a vaccine designed to stimulate a strong immune response, we can elicit significant anti-cancer reactions, potentially leading to a universal cancer vaccine." For over 8 years, Sayor has been pioneering high-tech anti-cancer vaccines using lipid nanoparticles and mRNA. This latest research builds on a previous breakthrough where an mRNA vaccine reprogrammed the immune system to attack glioblastoma, an aggressive brain tumor. In their recent study, the team tested a generalized mRNA vaccine in mouse models, seeing promising results, particularly when combined with PD-1 inhibitors, which help the immune system recognize tumors as foreign. Remarkably, in some cases, the tumors were completely eliminated. The findings suggest the potential for a universal cancer vaccine that could activate the immune system and work alongside existing therapies. The research team is now focused on refining their formulations and advancing to human clinical trials as quickly as possible. In a controversial move, the Environmental Protection Agency has announced a proposal to rescind the landmark legal opinion that underpins its regulations aimed at curbing climate change. This decision threatens to dismantle essential protections against greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles, power plants, and oil and gas operations. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin claims this could be the largest deregulatory action in U.S. history. He argues that the agency lacks the authority to combat global climate change. However, critics are not holding back. Zelan Hoover, a former senior advisor at the EPA, called this move an attack on both science and common sense, pointing to the growing evidence that climate change is harming public health and safety. This proposal directly targets the 2009 endangerment finding, which established that greenhouse gases endangered public health, allowing the EPA to regulate them under the Clean Air Act. By striking at this legal foundation, the agency argues it no longer has the power to regulate emissions. Diana Furchtgott-Roth from the Conservative Heritage Foundation supports the rollback, claiming it reduces burdens on businesses. But environmental advocates warn this could lead to a resurgence of polluting vehicles on our roads, exacerbating the climate crisis. Experts are sounding alarms about the implications of this decision. Richard Revez, a law professor, cautions that the administration is taking a risky gamble. Instead of weakening regulations one by one, they're attempting a sweeping removal that could backfire. The EPA's proposal now enters a 45-day public comment period, but environmental groups are already gearing up for legal battles. David Doniger from the Natural Resources Defense Council argues that this move contradicts established legal standards, asserting that greenhouse gases must be treated as air pollutants. As the nation faces increasing wildfires, floods, and heat waves, this proposal raises serious concerns. Doniger warns that if implemented, it could usher in a future of unchecked emissions, jeopardizing public health and safety. With this decision, the EPA risks prioritizing corporate interests over the well-being of the planet and its people, igniting a fierce debate about the future of environmental protection in America. In Maryland, President Trump has denied a request for FEMA disaster aid following severe flooding in western Maryland. Governor Wes Moore has sought almost $16 million in relief for extensive damage caused by extreme rainfall between May 12 and 14, which saw water levels rise to a historic 12.4 feet in Georges Creek. The flooding forced evacuations in Allegheny and Garrett counties, with school children being ferried to safety by boat. Over 200 homes, along with numerous businesses, roads, bridges, and public utilities, were severely impacted. Governor Moore stated in a response to the denial, quote, "These communities demonstrated a clear need through FEMA's own process, and Maryland will appeal the decision to seek all available resources for recovery," end quote. Maryland had met federal threshold requirements, including well over $300,000 for Allegheny County and over $11 million for the state, which should have triggered public assistance from FEMA. However, a senior FEMA official indicated that supplemental federal assistance under the Stafford Act was deemed not warranted without further explanation. FEMA has a history of denying aid, with a denial rate of 38% for applications from 2020 to 2023, and as high as 45% for states like Maryland and Virginia, where property values are higher. The denial has raised concerns about potential bias against Democratic-run states that have challenged the Trump administration. Just a day after denying Maryland's request, Trump approved disaster relief for several other states, including West Virginia, Kentucky, Indiana, and Michigan. Senators Chris Van Hollen, Angela Also Brooks, and Representative April McLean Delaney issued a joint statement urging Trump to reconsider the aid, emphasizing the ongoing need of communities in Allegheny and Garrett counties. 2 months after flash flooding, they are still in need of support to repair schools, libraries, and infrastructure, the lawmakers said. The state can formally appeal FEMA's decision within 30 days, and Governor Moore has indicated that Maryland will do so. In the meantime, the state has provided just under $460,000 from its state disaster recovery fund, which has faced budget shortfalls. Moore affirmed in a statement, quote, "We will continue to stand with our fellow Marylanders in Western Maryland as they rebuild from the damage caused in May," end quote. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is James Kemp and Josh Salem. The producer is Hannah Francis, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Brian Bull and Catherine Carley. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.